You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 20th to the 26th of April 2017. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by books editor Karen Shook, deputy news editor John Morgan, and reporter John Elms. Theresa May, the UK Prime Minister, has called a snap general election, you may have heard. It will take place on June the 8th and could have ramifications for the HE and research bill. John Morgan will have the latest in just a moment. Are the world's research funders doing enough to support maverick researchers? UCL's Donald Graben doesn't think so, and he says as much in this week's lead opinion, which is also endorsed by 36 interested parties, including two Nobel laureates. John Elms has been speaking to a number of Nobel Prize winners this week to seek their views on this important issue. And our final words this week go to Karen Shook, books editor of THE for 10 years now. This, alas, will be her final week at the Higher, so we'll have a rundown of this week's book section in her dulcet tones for one last time. But first, John Morgan, over to you. Just after press day, actually, this week, Theresa May, the UK Prime Minister, announced that there will be a general election in the UK in June. It seems a good time to cover it now. You've been writing about it this week for the THE website.
That's right, Chris. Most immediately for universities, the election announcement has a pretty major implication in threatening the future of the higher education and research bill. So basically, the bill was scheduled to come back to the House of Commons, having been significantly amended by the House of Lords around about 25th of April, but now Parliament is going to be dissolved ahead of the election on 3rd of May, so that leaves the government facing a bit of a race against time to get it passed before the election. So the Lords made some really major amendments to the bill. So the bill is about creating a new sort of market-style regulator who would drive the creation of a more market approach in English higher education and bringing in new private providers to compete with universities. The Lords have amended that, sort of limiting the government's ability to bring in new providers. And another amendment says that the new teaching excellence framework couldn't be used to set universities' fees. And there's an important one that would take international students out of the government's net migration count. So basically, the government would previously have wanted to throw out all those amendments, and they would have had the time to have a pretty good shot at doing that, getting rid of it all. But now there's a period of time that's known as the wash-up, where the government tries to deal with outstanding bills before an election. And in that wash-up process, they've got to come to a deal with the opposition, and basically the opposition has an effective veto in the wash-up, because if they don't agree to the government rushing through measures, then the bills aren't going to get through. So basically what's going to happen with the HE bill is it looks like the government is going to have to offer some really major compromises if it wants to get the legislation through.
And even before that time pressure came in, you were reporting this week on some backbench Tory MPs who were threatening to rebel on some of those amendments. So pressure was already on.
Yes. So I mentioned the International Students Amendment that was proposed by Lord Hannay and passed by the Lords, and that states that no student shall be treated for public policy purposes as a long-term migrant to the UK. So that would basically have the effect of taking overseas students out of the government's net migration target, reducing net migration to the tens of thousands. That's a long-standing aim of universities, to have students spared from the effect of that target, because they're worried it creates an incentive for the government to drive down international student numbers. And that had been worrying a lot of Tory MPs, this issue. And speaking to a couple of them, Nicky Morgan, the former Tory Education Secretary, and Ben Howlett, MP for Bath, they were both willing to rebel against the government and back the Hannayan amendment. But the feeling is that ultimately, more significant than the amendment would be the compromises that the government would make to have that amendment nullified and taken out and buy off the rebels. So I think supported the amendment we're looking for would be sort of the government committing not to make any further overseas student policy until there's much better data on the number of students who are overstaying their visas, and possibly dropping plans that Amber Rudd, the Home Secretary, announced last year to introduce tougher rules for overseas students coming to study on so-called low-quality courses. But what the rushing through of the bill will mean for negotiations over the International Students Amendment remains to be seen. I guess the government will have to buy off the potential rebels even quicker.
Thank you, John. You can, of course, read about all those issues on timeshighereducation.com. We also have on there a number of analysis pieces, including one from Nick Hillman, the director of the Higher Education Policy Institute. He's writing about that snap general election as well, as well as a number of more general news pieces on the announcement from the Prime Minister. Moving on, our lead opinion piece this week is written by Don Braidman, who is an honorary professor in the Department of Earth Sciences and in the Office of the Vice Provost for Research at University College London. He writes in his opinion piece this week that since about 1970, there have been large changes in the way that academic research is funded, owing to substantially increased numbers of academics and universities. The unforeseen consequence, he writes, is that exciting, imaginative, unpredictable research without thought of practical ends is stymied. You can read that on page 26, but you'll see more about that topic in our news section, John. You've been speaking to a number of pretty illustrious scholars.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, the point of this opinion piece is, it's not only is it authored by Don Braidman, who's a very well-renowned scholar and has written a lot on this matter in the past. It's also signed by 36 eminent scholars from around the world, two of which are Nobel laureates. And so, you know, there's clearly a lot of academic weight behind this piece. And so we thought it'd be a good idea to check out, see what the opinions, if they had any, of course they do, of the Nobel laureates who signed, co-signed this piece, to see what they thought their thoughts were about this funding of imaginative and unpredictable research that Don Braidman talks about. And I mean, unsurprisingly, they're in total agreement. I contacted Sir Richard Roberts, who's the joint winner of the 1993 Nobel Prize for Physiology or Medicine. And he said, you know, as a researcher, that those who challenge the dogma of the field and who don't necessarily, you know, go into research knowing what they're going to find out, but then do find something by chance, are the ones who tend to make the big discoveries. He mentioned to me that the biggest discoveries, the ones that have led to research that then in turn lead to Nobel Prize winners, and big discoveries for the greater good of mankind, happen by chance. And the fact is that funding models, current funding models, and the continuation of funding models are stymieing this research, because they're only seemingly funding research that kind of has an answer that they can prove will have an impact. And, you know, you can't, academics the world over show that you can't predict necessarily what is going to happen in a discovery and what impact it will have on mankind later on when you're doing your funding proposals.
But you can't ask for money just on the basis that you might stumble upon something. I mean, I guess it's reasonable to ask people to set out their aims and objectives, and perhaps during the course of that they can, you know, make these discoveries.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But I mean, something that actually wasn't included in the piece, as Sir Richard pointed out to me, you know, there's still an importance of basic understanding of sciences, particularly in the area of biology, one of part of his field. You know, these kind of areas do need basic understanding of science, which then lead to greater investigations and discoveries. And he made the point that actually that the funding that he got for the research that he carried out that led to his Nobel Prize probably wouldn't be funded in today's climate. He actually said that the questions he was asking were probably seen too basic, and that the funders would probably thought they already knew the answer. It was only by chance through his research that they found stuff that led to this massive discovery that led to the Nobel Prize. He also made a point that, you know, as academics, people go into academia or going to become researchers for the love of expanding their own knowledge and horizons and the understanding of humanity in a perspective field. So by stymieing the unpredictable research, the blue sky thinking, you're actually potentially putting off young academics. And in fact, that was seconded by Dudley Hirschbach, the Baird Professor of Science at Harvard University, who shared the 1986 Nobel Prize for Chemistry. He said that his research that led to his was the Nobel Prize was at the lunatic fringe of chemistry and could not have been started if I had to get funding via the peer review system that they're railing against today. And he said that current funding models continuing to fund research in this manner would inhibit development of young scientists because they won't have the freedom to follow where their research project leads, you know, looking up at those sparks of inspiration that one gets from carrying out basic science research. And yeah, they were very forthright in their opinions that they do need to apportion funding to this unpredictable research, the research that you can't predict the impact straight away from, so that potentially in the future the discoveries that have led to really important parts of society, as Don Braben puts in his piece, will continue to flourish. I mean, Sir Richard says that eventually, you know, innovation, there's a good chance that innovation will dry up if they don't.
Absolutely. Perhaps there's a THE campaign there. More funding for the lunatic fringe. moving on, Karen, one last time. Your book section this week, packed full of a vibrant mix as ever.
Still trying to cram as many books as I can into the section. This week in New and Noteworthy, a book a lot of people are talking about by Kate Raworth from the University of Oxford, Donut Economics, Seven Ways to Think Like a 21st Century Economist. Raworth talks about the ludicrous nature, the lunatic fringe, you might say, of standard economics that she was taught as a student, and her students are increasingly rejecting. So she looks at ecological, feminist, and behavioral theory for the sweet spot society. That's the donut of the title. Also in New and Noteworthy, a brilliant young scholar from Cambridge, Orr Rosenbaum, international relations scholar, the emergence of globalism, not a 21st century idea, but in fact, if you look at the debates in the 1940s amongst people like Barbara Wooden, Friedrich Hayek, Polanyi, Niebuhr, H.G. Wells, Lionel Robbins, they were already looking at those issues. Rhodri Jeffries-Jones writes a fantastic study of surveillance in Britain and America called We Know All About You, but perhaps you know all about that book already. And a very fine biography by Gregor Gall of the late RMT union leader Bob Crow, an extremely impressive man. John Shand, a philosopher at the Open University, has written a wonderful review of a book called A Fragile Life, Accepting Our Vulnerability. Kimono, who knew? I didn't. It means a thing to wear. But a very fine study by an anthropologist of this Japanese mode of dress, which is not only a traditional garment, but a trendy street fashion, so we read. Elizabeth Cobbs, who's a contributor of ours, also a very fine American historian, has written a study of America's first women soldiers, the Hello Girls. They were, in the First World War, telephone operators who trained and were served in the US Army. Of course, at the end of the war, June 1919, you would think there would be veterans benefits, victory medals, round of applause. They were recognized as veterans in 1979. Mm-hmm. Annika Horvath from the Center for Global Higher Education at UCL gives us a review of Lawrence Bush's book, Knowledge for Sale, The Neoliberal Takeover of Higher Education. Bush compares free market politics and the higher education sector with state socialism. Annika grew up in Ceausescu's Romania. She takes issue with some of that. And our book of the week author, Stuart Hall, one of the biggest of big names in 20th century scholarship in the UK, the father of cultural studies. This book, Familiar Stranger, Life Between Two Islands, was a quasi-memoir that he began with his editor, Bill Schwartz, about 20 years ago, an incredibly prolific scholar, as people will know, and Schwartz's work, he's also the editor of a 12-volume series, The Writings of Stuart Hall, was invaluable in here. And it was reviewed by, I would have to say, of all my beloved reviewers, perhaps one of the most beloved, Fred Ingalls, who writes from a position of knowing Stuart Hall rather well. Speaking for myself, he says, a dazzled admirer 5 years his junior, I've never met anyone I more longed for as a friend, but then countless others felt the same. It's lovely to end after 10 years as books editor with a book of the week written Book of the Week review written by possibly the most beautiful writer I've ever had the pleasure to edit in my section. That's Fred.
Thank you, Karen. If there's anything you wish to comment in response to the topics that we've covered today, or indeed anything on our website and in our magazine, you can do so at timeshighereducation.com. You'll also find us on Facebook, on Twitter, and on LinkedIn. I'll leave you with words not from me, but from a letter on page 29 of this week's magazine, which reads as follows. As some of the scholars who have been lucky enough to review books in the pages of Times Higher Education, we'd like to say thank you to Karen Shook. She leaves the role of books editor for Pastures New. She's been a generous, responsive, open and thoughtful editor with a sense of what matters and a deep understanding of what makes academics and academic work tick. We wish her the very best. That's signed by a number of our contributors, including Shahida Bari, Helen Castor and the aforementioned Fred Ingalls too. That's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.